Quietus contains homeopathic ingredients traditionally used to provide relief.
Can you hear that sound? That ringing. That hissing.
I can't get to sleep with it.
I can't concentrate. I hear it constantly. Everywhere I go, it doesn't go away. It drives me nuts.
It's tinnitus.
A constant ringing in your ear caused by loud machines.
Loud music.
Ah, finally. Quietus.
I love Quietus.
I couldn't believe it. No more ringing in the ears. No more hissing sound.
Quiet relief so I can work.
No more ringing. No more loud fans.
And I sleep like a baby.
If you're suffering from tinnitus, I urge you to try Quietus.
After trying Quietus, the ringing stopped and I felt like I got my life back.
Quietus is real, my friend.
Quietus has changed my life.
Call right now for your risk-free trial of Quietus at 1-800-860-8517. That's 1-800-860-8517. Stop the ringing now. 1-800-860-8517. That's 1-800-860-8517.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Everybody get ready for Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. A foodie born and bred, my wife Nikki loves chatting up chefs, dining out, and insider industry buzz.
And my husband David thinks a great meal is nothing but a good burger, a frosty brew, and a check for under $20. Because he is cheap.
Well, maybe so, but Foodie married Beast anyway, and together we've got the food and wine variety show that has everyone talking.
It's Foodie and the Beast, and we are on now.
Well, welcome back to Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. We're going to get into the show in a minute, but I'm sitting next to Chef Jacques Herringer from L'Auberge Chez Francois, and when that thing about me being cheap and $20 came on, he looked at me, and the look in his eye said, don't even ask for a glass of water at my place.
So, no, that's
say
not
no
true.
For $20.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. Nobody says no to $20. All right, so we're back. It seems like just a minute ago we were live at Union Market, and
I
that
know.
Was a cool show, and we
amazing
had a lot
show.
Of fun. And,
well, actually, we have, if you're interested, we have a Facebook photo album with the link to the show, so you can listen to it and look through the pictures and
yeah,
see
I
all
look,
the fun.
I look really hot.
Yeah, you do.
Oh, yeah. I'm crazy.
Good.
And I do want to congratulate my near and dear friend Barry Obama on his reelection. Thank goodness. Welcome
what does that
back
have to do
the
with
White
the
House.
Price of tea in China?
I'm welcoming the president back for another 4 years because
okay.
that's what I want to do.
How
all right,
it?
So we were supposed to have Mitch Berliner from Central Farm Markets on the phone with us today, but we can't reach him, so we'll talk a little bit about their news. We'll
yep.
call him the late Mitch Berliner.
Okay.
And as I said, Chef Jacques Herringer, who's the chef de cuisine and owner of L'Auberge Chez Francois, is with us. He's doing the you're doing the media rounds. He's going to be on the Today Show. He's going to be on the Talk. But first, he stopped off here with a little bit of advice
naturally,
for our holiday tables.
But of course,
and I too am happy that the president was reelected because
okay,
national health care is wonderful for the restaurant business because you're going to eat, drink, be merry. And you're going to help save Social Security and Medicare by passing a little sooner. So
dude, it's
it is our
you're
job.
Talking,
it's our
now,
patriotic
wait,
duty
now
to help.
Now you're on the wrong show. All right.
Okay. Well, also with us today, we will be talking with Triple James Beard Award-winning chef, restaurateur, and cookbook author Tom Douglas of Seattle's famous Dahlia Bakery. He just dropped a new book. We're going to be talking all about that. And a lot of people are talking about Green Hat Gin. You've been seeing it all over the place around D.C. And we got the guys behind it. Tom Uselton and Michael Lowe are in studio, and they brought gin.
Now.
Yes.
And Phil Green, speaking of gin and booze, Phil Green, he's one of the founding members of the Museum of the American Cocktail.
Mm-hmm.
He's been in here before, but talk about dropping a book. It's like dropping a baby, but it's dropping a book.
Since you've done it so many times,
he
I'm
wrote
sure
a
you
book
understand
called
what that's
To Have
like.
And To Have Another, a Hemingway cocktail companion, and I've been reading through it. It's really a fascinating kind of, it sort of follows Hemingway's parallel paths through his torturous trail in writing and all the booze that helped him do it, essentially. Am I right? I'm right.
You are. Thank you. It's sort of a cocktail lover's guide to his life in prose, life and times.
So. And we're calling you a mixographer. Huh? Eh?
No,
works for
no
me.
We're not. Okay. No, we're not.
Yeah, it's in
I'm
the
not.
It's in the foreword to the book, so we are.
Okay.
Anyways.
Well, how about you can? And now, since I was just out at Trademark in Alexandria, we're very excited to have mixologist Chris Bassett in with us this morning. You can move that mic. Oh, sorry, you can't move that mic. What?
Yeah.
I'm introducing him.
Yes, please do.
Okay. So he's in to join us. Trademark just
Who's
opened.
Who's on first?
Out in Alexandria. Chris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the restaurant?
All right. Well, it's called Trademark. We're located right by the Patent Trademark Office, kind of what we're named after.
Catchy name.
Original, right? So anyway, our program there is we're focusing on local and inventive. Our cocktail menu right now is just classics, some of them with a little twist on those classics. The menu's the same way, comfort-style American food with our own little twist on it, something new and inventive and fun.
But talk about a little bit about the cocktail program that you put together there. I mean, you trained with Todd Thrasher, who is well-known in the mixology community. I mean, that's like dropping such a name. So how did Todd's influence affect you and the menu that you put together?
Well, but was with Todd for about the last 15 months.
And you can stand up straight? That's amazing.
Yeah, I know, right? Todd's a great guy. I've been bartending for almost 20 years, but I learned more from Todd in the last 15 months than I have in my entire career bartending. Just the way he develops drinks, it was a great experience for me. So I kind of took a lot of that into this program here at Trademark. So we're starting off with a lot of classics, just to kind of give people an idea that, hey, we know what we're doing over there, so come check us out.
Mm-hmm.
And as we move into seasons, we'll get more seasonal, fresh stuff is kind of my main focus. Anything that I can get my hands on, really, that's going to be fun, creative, inventive, new, something that people maybe haven't seen before.
Well, so let's give us an example.
Sure. I'll start with our Trademark Old Fashioned.
Okay, you have to keep your face in front of the mic.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
So it starts off with a little bit of brown sugar muddled in with some grapefruit peel. Were you using Jefferson's Reserve Bourbon? So it's out of Kentucky, but since it's named after Thomas Jefferson, it's kind of got a Virginia feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
And because Jefferson had pomegranates at Monticello, put a little bit of pomegranate juice in there, kind of add a little flavor to it there. So,
you know what? I'm not really a bourbon guy, but that looks great.
It's a fantastic drink.
It does. Ice sound effects. Nice
right,
going,
right,
Andy.
Right, right.
Very nice, Andy. Very, very
Keep
nice.
It authentic.
Right. But you put in a very little bit of the pomegranate
Just
juice.
A spoonful. We're using Bitterman's grapefruit hop bitters in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of offset those bitters.
You know, somebody, I don't know if it was Adam Hurst or somebody asked me last week how we keep from getting lit up on this show with all the alcohol.
You don't drink all of it
we
until
don't?
The show is over.
I do. That could be why. I said, what do you mean? How do we stop?
And why the big square ice cube as opposed to little ones? Is that like aesthetics, or do you feel like the way that ice melts, it'll give the right amount of water to the drink?
All of the above.
Okay.
More surface area for that ice, so it melts a little bit slower.
Mm-hmm.
So it keeps the drink fresher. Plus, like you said, aesthetics, it looks a lot nicer.
Okay,
that
Phil
way.
Has something to add.
Well, as you'll read in my book, Hemingway used to make ice cubes with tennis ball cans. When he made martinis, he didn't want small ice cubes melting and not, you know, making the drink cold enough. So he would make these giant ice cubes with tennis ball cans. He would also freeze his onions to put in the martini. So they were like little refrigerators inside the glass.
Oh, that's such a good idea.
That's terrible. I froze my onions once.
Okay.
So, Chris, while you're making up that drink, I do want to get Mitch's plug in here, even though Mitch is
MIA.
Central Farm Markets, which has markets in Bethesda and Rockville, is holding its annual Thanksgiving market at the Pike, on Rockville Pike, where... the old Silver Diner was before they moved. And it's Tuesday, November 20th from 10 to 2.
Well, I think you should say that normally the market is held on Saturdays, but they're doing a special one just for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, so this is abnormally on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got 22 vendors with everything from soup to nuts for a Thanksgiving dinner. So,
get out
Mitch,
there.
Where,
10
wherever
to 2.
You are, Mitch, we did it. We plugged it. Okay.
There we go.
All right, so Jacques Herringer is the son of the founder of L'Auberge Chez François, and he is the current owner and chef de cuisine, and he is, as I said, you started here, God bless you, but you're doing
but
a big
media swing.
But of
course, where else could one start but here?
Mon Dieu, mon ami. So, you know, Thanksgiving's upon us, and the real question that I have for you, and, you know, let's see if you can answer it, is how does a French restaurant prepare for and interpret what is the quintessential American holiday meal?
We do... with the turkey, we have Ashley Farms turkeys out of North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And we do a chestnut stuffing, actually. I actually have a chestnut tree.
You have one right next to you.
I have one.
We're
I have
clinking.
A chestnut tree.
Cheers,
oh, we're
cheers,
clinking.
Everybody.
I have a chestnut tree on the 6 acres there. We make a chestnut stuffing with pork and spices and chestnuts and match that with the turkey. And other than that, we have cranberry sauce and all the trimmings. We'll also have roast pork and a lot of the traditional recipes that we have, you know, the classic recipes that we're known for will also be available. Turkey Day is a huge day for us. When we first opened, we always go, God, we still need to open on Thanksgiving. We first opened, we needed the money, so we had to stay open all the days, and it's become such a tradition, of course, that we want to keep it going. And the holidays are fabulous.
Well, do you find that people come back year after year?
There are some people that just come every Thanksgiving.
They just come every Thanksgiving. It's a nice tradition.
Well, it's a special occasion place, so people come once a year. I know we've tried to change the menu a little bit here and there, and the hue and cry sometimes, it goes, oh, but I came for that dish. And I go, when was the last time you were here? Well, our anniversary 3 years ago.
Yeah,
but that's
bad.
Good. That's the good news that people enjoy. I think we all do the same. We go to a place because we enjoyed something, and often we want that same dish or the same nice drink.
Drink, right,
if you're a mixologist. So,
well, but let me ask a question. Am I right? Your dad was from Alsace originally?
My dad was from Alsace.
All right. So how... I mean, is there an Alsatian holiday that sort of matches up to, you know, the harvest time and to Thanksgiving? No,
of course they do les vendanges. I mean, you have the harvest.
Course.
Yeah, those kinds of celebrations. Traditionally, at Christmas in Alsace, it's roast goose with chestnut stuffing. So we're just doing the roast turkey for Thanksgiving, and then during the holidays, we have roast goose with chestnut stuffing, which is quintessential.
Goose is hard to find in town.
Yeah, it's your quintessential sort of Teutonic, because Alsace is the Teutonic side of France,
if you
will.
Well, it depends on who's invading.
Well, you know, I think that they come over, our cousins across the Rhine come over every so often because of the good food and the wine.
You could call that an invasive meal. Why is goose hard to find?
A lot of people don't serve goose.
They don't serve it.
But it is making a comeback. I think for a while chefs in general who were serving during the holidays did not feel that people would order goose. But now people are actually requesting it.
We've always
it.
Had. We've done
Have
it. For
you?
We've been there 36 years. I was 10, as you can tell, when I started there.
Of course.
Good
of
thing
course.
This is radio.
Yes.
And we've always had the roast goose during the holiday season. It's very popular. And again, some folks just come out during the holiday season for the roast goose.
Well, what about for people who do decide to stay at home? What's something that you do in your restaurant that you think would be like a nice twist? Whether, like, for example, like, let's talk
she
about
She wants
your...
to say a French twist, but she hasn't got the guts.
Right.
Yeah.
I have the guts,
but
I
will.
I just wouldn't say it.
You know, we wrestled with it.
Well, like, let's talk about, like, the hors d'oeuvres you brought in.
You got to get in front of that microphone.
I brought some assorted canapes. We have smoked salmon. We have an apple and Roquefort canapé. Mm-hmm. We have pâté that we make ourselves, a country pâté. We have rillette, which is traditional in Alsace, which is goose, back to goose, and pork, which is...
Rillette,
it's called potted meat in English. English. That's why we never get along with the British, because they call rillette. If you call it rillette, it's $29.95. If you call it potted meat, it's $1.95. You know what I mean? That's how
that's
all got here in Washington,
secret.
Right?
Hold on, I would like some of that rillette.
Spoken like a retailer.
So, and look, Nikki, I don't want people cooking at home. I don't write cookbooks so people will cook at home. I write cookbooks so you'll see it on the shelf and go, honey, we haven't been there lately.
Well, you know, it's a little bit of both.
I know.
Don't
well, we were wrestling, to answer your question, we were wrestling with that for the talk. What can we do a little bit different for the holidays, especially in California? So I said, why don't we do a seafood lover's celebration? In other words, we'll do a bouillabaisse, which is a great winter dish, and we'll do all the seafood, and that's something that's fairly simple to prepare at home. And now, of course, you can have all your seafood FedExed in, which is what we do at the restaurant. So much of our stuff comes directly from the source now.
Right.
And that's what we're going to do on the talk. And then they said, well, what about a vegan version? Well, you could make a vegetable broth with saffron and then poach root vegetables
if
you want to do a vegan. And that's what we're going to do.
All right.
How are you finding that in the restaurant? Are people asking more for vegans? Like, especially with the change in your menus and the brasserie area?
We always have a vegetarian entree and a vegetarian app on the menu. And then what we do is take requests, because more and more people have allergies and special requests. And we're doing more and more of that. Actually, I took the whole menu and did the gluten-free thing, you know, broke it down so people would know what it was. So we take requests, and we're happy to do that. And we had a great garden this year, so we had lots and lots of vegetables. I mean, it was fantastic garden.
Is that something you're going to continue to do?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I think I'm going to expand it. We had a smaller version last year and had a little plastic fence, and the deer went right through it, of course. And this year we have like a stockade. For anyone who complains at the restaurant.
With a machine gun nest.
No, deer can't get over this one. This is huge.
All right. If you don't know where L'Auberge Chez Francois is, you're new to Washington. But let's tell everybody where you are physically and on the web so that...
Well, we have some time when we come back from the break.
I know. I just want to make sure, you know.
We're at 332 Springvale Road in Great Falls.
Mm-hmm.
And we're at L'AubergeChezFrancois.com.
If you can't spell that,
or ChefJacques.com. And
well, and when we come
back,
we have to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to talk about you have some great DVDs and cookbooks that you're selling for the holidays. This is David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast. We're going to be drinking a lot. We'll be back in just a sec.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth every Saturday on 1500 AM. Join me this week for my special guest, John Allen, founder of Bluestone Capital Partners. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, located in Reston, Virginia, serving the entire D.C. metro area. For more information about the firm, visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
When every moment matters and a hand reaches out, when someone gives blood and a life is saved, that moment when heartbreak turns to hope, you're there through the American Red Cross. Every day, the Red Cross responds to nearly 200 neighborhood emergencies, and your support makes it possible. Use this moment to join us today. Visit redcross.org.
Union Market is becoming DC's go-to place for fresh, delicious everything, especially American lamb. Increasingly, chefs and home cooks find American lamb to be the perfect balance of flavor and nutrition. American lamb is easy to cook and brings variety to your table. The American Lamb Board reminds you to look for American lamb year-round at Harris Teeter, and don't miss Craig Rogers' signature Border Springs Farm Lamb at DC's spectacular new Union Market.
Soon this little baby I'm singing to sleep will start to walk. Before I know it, I'll be dropping her off at school, beaming when she walks up to accept her diploma, or holding back tears as she takes those big steps down the aisle. But before she takes all those steps, she and thousands like her will need you to take yours. Join March for Babies to help make her steps possible.
March for Babies!
Start your team today at marchforbabies.org.
Hey, we're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis, and Chef Jacques Herringer is with us. He's the chef and owner at L'Auberge Chez Francois in Great Falls, and we got a couple of minutes left. Can we talk quickly about desserts?
Because we certainly may.
You are the king of desserts, and anything special for the holidays?
Right, and you brought
I brought one along. It is a pumpkin mousse cake. So we take the pumpkin and we bake it with a little bit of maple syrup on it and scoop out the pulp, puree it. Then we take heavy whipping cream. You know you want it, 40% butterfat.
Right.
You know you do. Plus, we're going to be covered soon, so why worry about what you eat? And then we put Maker's Mark, no offense to the gin.
Right, but lots of gin in
distillers
studio.
Distillers today. So we put Maker's Mark, and we make it's a Bavarian cream.
Mm-hmm.
With Maker's Mark pumpkin, you could use tinned, not canned. You could use tinned puree of pumpkin at home,
okay.
Of course. But
I love the
we
way
make
the French sweet puree.
Puree
of pumpkin.
Can I talk to you just in French?
Please do.
Well, so, Chef, before we have to say goodbye to you, just tell people quickly. So your book is still available now.
The Two for Tonight is still available, the Chez Francois Cookbook. We've just come out with our show that was on PBS for 3 years, Two for Tonight on DVD.
Right.
I brought the X-rated version for David, of course.
Excellent. He needs it.
And then we have our Les Desserts.
Oh, it should be three for tonight.
The Ménage à Trois.
It's just him and him and him.
That's
how it works.
Why, it's me, myself, and I.
So those are available on the website and make wonderful foodie gifts, I think, for the holidays.
Excellent. Well, Chef, thank you so much for
joining us today.
Somebody give me a fork.
Please come out and try the brasserie when you can.
We will. We'll absolutely be loud. And everybody, please look for Chef. He's coming on The Talk, and he'll also be on The Today Show, both in December, correct?
Correct.
All right. We'll see you on TV.
Thank you so much. Happy holidays to all.
You too. Thanks for coming in. All right, Chris, we are coming back to you. This is very delicious, your drink. It's really strong, first thing in the morning.
It is.
What are you giving us next?
The next one is called our Commonwealth Cocktail. Mm-hmm. It's a tribute to Virginia. We're using Wassmann's single malt whiskey. Wassmann's is a local whiskey that's made in the style of bourbon. Mm-hmm. It's got a little bit of Luxardo Maraschino liqueur, some Domaine Canton, and fresh lemon juice. So you're going to get nice whiskey flavors, some ginger notes, and then some tartness from the lemon as well.
Phil, isn't there a line about brown liquor early in the morning? Isn't there something about brown liquor that we should not be doing? Isn't there some line?
I'm not aware of that, but I'll look it up for you.
Okay. All right. Well, on the phone, we have famed chef Tom Douglas. Tom, are you there?
I certainly am.
Good morning. I know it's a little early out there in Seattle, but we appreciate you joining us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm from Newark, Delaware area originally, 35 years ago, so I still haven't accustomed myself to the time change.
Oh, and we love Newark because when we're on the Delaware Turnpike, we spend hours right there waiting to go someplace. So there you go.
Waiting to pay your tolls, no doubt.
Something.
Who knows?
Piper. So, all right. So anybody who knows anything about the food scene in Seattle really knows that the best way to start and end a day is at one of Tom Douglas's 11 awesome restaurants. And probably the best way to start the day anywhere is at the Dahlia Bakery. And... Tom, you've just dropped the Dahlia Bakery cookbook, and, you know, I mean, we've been reading through it. You're kind of a Triple Crown winner. You've won more James Beard Awards than you can shake a stick at. Now, our question is, how hard is it to maintain your edge? You're a chef, you're a leading restaurateur, and you're a cookbook author, and you're a pastry chef. Do you sleep?
I do sleep. I am not the latter, though. I'm more of a savory chef, and our Dahlia Bakery cookbook has got, you know, it's featuring certainly tons of pastries, but my specialty is more savory. I do that grilled cheese sandwich that's on the cover with the spicy broccoli rabe and my mom's tomato soup that I've turned into something of a little legend there at the Dahlia Bakery. We sell about 10 gallons a day, so that's always that's fun. And I often talk about, especially in the book, about the difference between savory chefs and pastry chefs and how we seem to, in the Rodney King world of things, can't we all just get along? We seem to be a bit odd sometimes in the kitchen because pastry chefs are so persnickety and kitchen, you know, savory chefs are pretty much whipped by the whiskey they drank the night before and come in a little groggy and then start to play their way to virtuosity through just throwing food together and at the end of the day putting something decent on the table.
Well, don't forget also, I mean, I feel like pastry chefs and chefs are also on different hours, you know, depending, you know, if there's bread being made and things of that nature. Like, you guys are on totally different hours. One's coming in, one's finishing up kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, and even bread chefs don't even consider themselves pastry chefs. So, yeah, there are different hours. They come in at 4 o'clock in the morning to get the ovens fired up, and then by 5 they're working on breakfast pastries, which we open at 6:15 at our first breakfast place. We have 5 that open for breakfast throughout the morning. But, yeah, they're up there, and they get the first transfer out with croissants and scones and things, and then they're right off on to lunch desserts. And while the bread chefs are making the breads, the hamburger buns, the rolls, everything that we use in the restaurants bread-wise, they're getting started for that first 10 o'clock transfer. And then here we come strolling in, us savory chefs, at 2 or 3, and they just kind of stare at us like...
Right. Like, oh, nice to see you. Glad you came to work.
Thanks for showing up.
Well, so I want to talk about the book just a little bit, as I didn't have time to... make anything out of it yet because I just received it. But it is a beautiful book with fabulous pictures. And one of the things I thought was interesting is that one of your signature items, which is the English muffin, you know, I read the recipe and you really advise making your own. And I was just sort of curious, for the uninitiated, why make your own English muffin? I mean, what is it about English muffins that you're pushing over there?
Well, here's the thing. For the uninitiated, for someone who doesn't really has never really baked before, I'd say don't start with the English muffin. That's a time-consuming, tough recipe. And there's a few tough recipes in there, but there's a bunch of simple ones, too. But what's fun about the English muffin is it's become a bit ubiquitous in our life. You know, do you want rye, sourdough, English muffin? You know, it's just one of those things. And lots of people have made bread, but they've never gone down the English muffin path. That's why we put it in there. We just thought it was fun. We've had lots of people, including Serious Eats and other folks in the food world, call them the best English muffin sandwiches they've ever had. And so we thought it'd be fun to kind of share the recipe and share the techniques. And it's just, you know, it begins as a blank slate when you get done. It's just a delicious little yeasty roll that has been baked on both sides, crusty edge on both sides. And, God, the things that you can put on top, from we make a little egg frittata with fine herbs. We make a fennel sausage with really spicy chili bomb peppers.
Yum.
We make, you know, just fried eggs, different cheeses, smoked salmon or gravlax sandwiches. It's just really a great base. And when you go through all that process to put all the beautiful ingredients on, it feels a bit odd sometimes to go and get a Thomas's English muffin and do all that without doing the work on the base. You know what I mean? That's why the English muffin.
Okay, well, I think it makes sense. I mean, especially when you're doing all that fabulous preparation and you're putting on all these unique flavors. I'm going to have to try.
That brings up another question, because
yes.
Seattle's considered kind of a mecca for being able to source a broad array of, you know, fresh and local ingredients, but there are parts of America that haven't caught up there. So are there going to be challenges for chefs in the hinterland?
For
cooks at home. Who are going to be looking at the book going, well, where do I find that, or how do I do that, or how do I make that, and so it's
right.
Still got that fresh taste?
Not a bit, because we're all about using what's local, right? So everyone's got what's local, whether this time of year it's apples and pears, and I'm sure that's pretty much across the country. So it's all about just substituting what's local. Really, the book is well tested. The Food and Wine magazine called them the best tested recipes they've ever come across. So we know they work, and it's a really good teaching manual. If you really want to learn to bake, if you're kind of intimidated by baking, take my book, take any baking book. Just pick three genres, say a cake, a cookie, and a pie, and make each of those three recipes exactly the way they're talked about in the book. I mean, don't start ad-libbing on my recipes. You know, make them three times exactly.
They're my recipes. Don't touch them.
You mean it's not a comedy book?
My recipes. Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? And then once that third time through, you will start to say, wow, now I get it. Now I'm starting to feel, oh, I like these a little bit browner. Oh, I want the center a little bit softer. Now you can start to ad lib on our recipes and make them perfect for you, but you'll have the confidence, having made them three times, that you are starting to become a baker. And it'll change your life. If you just spend the weekend doing what I just said, three recipes, three times each, mm-hmm. across different genres, it'll change your baking life. You'll be a baker for life.
Well, I think that's excellent advice. Mike, so let's say I were to do that. I mean, I bake. But let's just say, what would be in each category in your book? Which recipe would you advise?
Ooh, boy. Well, there's the peanut butter sandwich cookie, which is we call the Nora Ephron.
It's the first one on my list. That one looks amazing.
Yeah.
It really is good. I just made it last night. And, you know, she was a good friend of the restaurant and filmed Sleepless in Seattle at our restaurant. And, of course, you've got mail. And we became friends over the years. And sadly, she has passed. But that was her. She said that was the best cookie she ever tasted, ever.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite fun, and we were very honored. So I would start with that little peanut butter sandwich cookie. Maybe go into, say, the maple custard pie. I think, you know, getting a pie crust down and getting a nice custard filling down is really something that would give you confidence in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
It is, you know, they're ubiquitous across the range. Then you can make eclairs and you can make flans and all sorts of things once you understand custard. And then a cake, a simple little cake. And I'm trying to think of the name that we gave the chocolate cake in the book, like, doesn't come off the top of my head, but just a simple cake and then let it mix well.
You mean like the double chocolate layer cake with fluffy chocolate sour cream frosting, perhaps?
Perfect.
Okay,
what a memory. Unbelievable.
I got your book in front of me.
Mine like a steel trap.
Yeah, but, you know, and then you do that three times and, you know, give them to your neighbors and whatever. But I guarantee that at the end of the weekend, you will be beaming with pride of your baking prowess.
Okay. Well, so for those people, what would you advise to have in your pantry? Like, what are some absolute baking staples other than, you know, like fresh fruit, things of that nature, that you feel people should always have in their pantry so that they can whip something up, you know, when they want
to? Exactly. Well, you know, you're always going to want to buy fresh. So, you know, when you're taking the time and making the effort to start baking, it's not the time to pull out the baker's chocolate that's been in your baking drawer for the last 14 years.
Right.
It's the time to kind of start fresh. You're making the effort. I say the same thing with savory. If you're going to go out and buy, you know, a beef tenderloin that's at $25 a pound, it's not the time to use old spices or old garlic on it. Buy fresh and start again. It's the smallest part of your investment of your dinner. But so I think in baking, as far as being prepared, it's the time to have terrific measuring spoons, you know, a great set of measuring cups, both liquid and dry, and a scale. You know, all of our recipes, if you want to bake your best, You need to have a gram scale so that you can, when I say a dry cup of flour, you know, I don't care, you know, if you know how to measure correctly or not, it's always going to be different. I could, you know, but when you say I want 150 grams of flour, it's exactly that every time, and your recipes will come out much more consistent. So I think a scale changes a baker's life as far as the getting to the end product of what an author has to say in their book.
Well, I think that's excellent advice, and I think people are a little hesitant because they find maybe having a scale to be an odd thing to have in their house, but I think it's really excellent, excellent advice. Well,
yeah, if I say, you know, if I say of 17, you know, 5 cups of chopped chocolate, you know, that could range, that could be a 25% difference between what I have in my head and what I, you know, how small I chop my chocolate compared to your chocolate.
No.
You know, it's very simple math.
No, absolutely. It's math. I think we've heard that a lot lately. You know, we're in D.C. That's the kind of thing we talk about. All right. Well, Chef, we really appreciate you taking the time this morning to talk about your new book, The Dahlia Bakery Cookbook. Thank you so much for joining us. I assume it is available everywhere. Is that correct?
Pretty much everywhere. And it just made the New York Times bestseller list. And we're so excited about it. And I've been out promoting it. So thank you so much for having it and having it on your show.
Well, congratulations. And thank you for joining us this morning. This is David and Nikki Nellis with Foodie and the Beast. We will be back. We'll be talking gin and a little bit of Hemingway. We'll be back in just a sec.
Thanksgiving means family feasts, and there's no option like Founding Farmers and their new sister restaurant, Farmers Fisher's Bakers, to celebrate true food and drink. This year, experience Thanksgiving from restaurants that bring the best of American dining to our region. The menu is a special multi-course selection, including turkey, ham, fried chicken, and prime rib. Made from scratch side orders like mashed potatoes, cornbread stuffing, roasted vegetables, homemade breads, and scrumptious desserts. For just $35 per person, excluding alcohol, tax, and gratuity, and $20 per child under 12, you can enjoy a feast that's distinctively flavorful and special. Reservations are available now at wearefoundingfarmers.com or farmersfishersbakers.com.
The men and women of our National Guard and Reserve Forces are working hard on the battlefield and here at home. Employer support of the Guard and Reserve is working just as hard for them. For over 36 years, ESGR has paved the way for greater understanding between our Guard and Reserve Forces and their civilian employers, promoting a culture where all American employers support and honor the military service of their employees. Together, we all serve. To learn more, visit www.esgr.mil.
There are those who dedicate themselves to a sense of honor, to a life of courage, and a commitment to something greater than themselves. They have always defended this nation and each other. They still do. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Welcome to today's lottery drawing. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having money, don't rely on luck. Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering it. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
I didn't even get that. Did you get that commercial? I don't know. Anyways, this is David and Nikki Nellis back on Foodie and the Beast. Mm. We're going to go back to Chris Bassett for a minute. Chris, I want to talk more about your work with Todd Thrasher.
Okay.
Because we met him.
Years ago.
A couple years ago.
It's hard to talk when I have food in my mouth.
He grows his own herbs. He mixes his own stuff. I mean,
he makes his own ginger ale.
Everything. I mean, he's really a wild guy. So the question is, what does that do to your, I mean, are you growing a garden of spices? And
if I had the space, I'd love to. Right now I have to just get them in as fresh as I can.
I mean, does it change how you source that stuff?
It does a little bit. Obviously I want to be able to get stuff in that's fresh and in season. You know, I don't want to be using stuff that's, you know, summer herb that in the wintertime for a drink. So while I have the ability to do some of that stuff at my house, I can grow some stuff. You know, I got to rely on what I can get through through vendors and such. But
I also have to imagine that a trademark, you're working very closely with the chef.
Absolutely.
So that, you know, I think that's what we're finding. And Phil, you could agree or disagree, but I think a lot of bartenders, mixologists, whatever you want to call yourselves, are finding yourselves in the kitchen and looking at what the products are that are coming in. And you know, if they're going local, or they're using fresh in the kitchen, why wouldn't you do that at the bar as well, right?
Yeah, more and more you're seeing a culinary expression in cocktails. And speaking of Todd, Todd's going to be joining me on December 11th, the 5th Annual Holiday Cocktail Seminar, Museum of the American Cocktail, at The Passenger. He'll be presenting a holiday cocktail along with some other of D.C.'s best mixologists.
Well, cool. Chris, if you need help, we have the whole blacklight set up in our attic growing other stuff, and we can just grow herbs for you. So what are you mixing up next?
The next one I got here for you, for Nikki, we're going to step away from the brown liquors.
Okay.
It's a Pisco Punch. Most people are familiar with a Pisco Sour. Mm-hmm. So using the Pisco liquor, this has got also a fresh pineapple syrup that we made in-house, and then fresh lemon juice. So I think now Pisco is becoming a little more popular. It's from Peru. They use the Quebranta grape. It's made in the style of a grape brandy. It's an easy drinking liquor. I love it. I think it's fantastic. So enjoy.
Great. All right. Well, thank you. Okay. So next, we're getting into gin. And we are going to introduce
John Uselton and Michael Lowe of Green Hat Gin. The formal name of the distillery is New Columbia Distillers, but you guys were D.C.'s first craft distiller, am I correct?
We are D.C.'s first.
Are.
Right.
We
are
still here.
Yes, we're still here. We've only been open a little while, hoping we haven't closed already.
Right.
Yeah, no, you are.
We are D.C.'s first craft distillery ever, and first distillery in at least 100 years that we can find out from the history.
Can I ask a silly question? I mean, why do you think that is? I mean, have the laws changed that drastically?
Well, the laws have changed somewhat, but I think the biggest thing is sort of the development over the last couple of decades of, you know, first the sort of small wineries movement out in California and the West Coast, and followed by the micro breweries.
I was going to say craft beer.
The craft beer.
Mm-hmm.
And then starting maybe 15 years ago or so, micro distilleries got started. D.C. just happened not to have one. So we thought it would be a great opportunity to bring something new to the district and sort of follow on with the locavore and local drink movement.
But what are your roots in distilling? I mean, was it just a personal love of drinks and you were like, I think I can do this on my own? I mean, how did you both get involved in this?
My background is in restaurants. I've worked in restaurants for almost 20 years. And then I've also was a beer buyer at a wine and beer store on the Hill for the last couple of years. And so my background has always had some kind of alcohol in it of some sort.
Don't worry, we're not going to say anything nasty about you. We're all friends in here. We're very nice.
John, I'm going to say your background and your foreground.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. Well, I didn't want to change midstream, you know, since I already have this background going.
Right.
And, you know, basically a couple of years ago, Michael had retired, and he was looking for, you know, we were talking about maybe a project of some sort, and he was doing a lot of experimenting with home brewing at home with some beers and doing a lot of experimentations with the beers and such, and we started doing some research and looking at some options and found, you know, at the same time we're doing some cocktail stuff at home and find that, you know, there's a group out there and they're making craft spirits and that it's something that can be done. I mean, you're asking about why there wasn't one here. I mean, I think it's just like the breweries. You know, you look at most cities in the United States, there was at least a craft brewery in most major cities, you know, for the last, say, 10 years. And D.C. just got their first one a year and a half ago or so.
Right.
So
no, I mean, all of a sudden now there's like you got Three Star and D.C. Brow.
Yeah.
I mean, quite a revolution happening locally.
Yeah, and I think that D.C. was a little bit, you know, not quite trying to, you know, wasn't quite with the rest of the country on getting these things, but we're trying to make up for time, I think.
All right, so Green Hat, let's talk about that. What makes that different than
others? What were you looking, what were you looking at? Like, what kind of gin were you trying to drink?
It's probably categorized as an American dry gin, as opposed to a London dry, which is a particular style that we're
Can
all
familiar
with.
Can you just explain what the differences are between the two styles?
Typically, American dry, I mean, dry means it's not a sweet gin, not like an Old Tom or something like that. But the American dry style tends to be a little more flavorful and more sort of adventurous in different combinations of botanicals. All right, would you add anything on that, John?
No, I mean, you know, the English dried gin is kind of a set standard.
Okay.
You know, there's a juniper quality to it. There's a citrus quality to it. And then the rest of the botanicals are really, really kind of normal.
When you say botanicals,
yeah.
I think people need to know what that means. In my head, I see greenery everywhere, you know, but like, what does botanicals mean in your profile? Like, what were you looking for in it?
Well, we've got, botanicals generally just mean, you know, the flavorings that go into the last distillation in making a gin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's herbs, spices, some roots, various. You know, there are 40 or 50 different, or more than that, different botanicals that gin makers have used.
Okay.
And we wanted to try to get a nice balance. We wanted a sort of chewy gin, and by that I mean something that has enough flavor that maybe a whiskey drinker might like it straight. But we needed to balance, you know, you've got to have the juniper, or it's not gin.
But the scent is not really floral. I think some gins are really, have that real floral note right when you smell it. And that's not, you don't have that in this.
You should be getting juniper and a little bit of coriander on the nose and probably a little bit of the...
Yeah, it's a little more spice than that. Do you know what I mean? Don't you find some gins are a little, that floral... Maybe it's too much juniper. I don't know what that smell is.
And that's kind of a typical, you know, gin note. So is that juniper and the citrus notes. And when we started doing our blends for our specific botanicals, we started with 40 different botanicals, did some infusions, and then we whittled that down to the 12 that we have.
Okay.
And basically, we knew that we could not compete against, you know, a gin who's making, you know, with citrus and just juniper. You know, because you can go out there and find some really well-made ones at a lot less than we can produce them for.
Of course.
So we wanted something that was a little bit different. So, like, ours has a little sage in it and the lemongrass. And there's, you know, these kind of notes with our botanicals that kind of we were trying to set it apart.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted it to be interesting, but not to be, you know, off-putting and kind of weird. We still wanted it to be able to, so that people could make, you know, cocktails with it and... you know, it'd be very universal and be able to be used in a lot of different cocktails, make a nice gin and tonic, you know, kind of things.
I wanted to, so I know we have,
We got 45 seconds.
Okay,
so I want to make sure everybody knows where to find.
Yeah. Where can people find you? And I mean, are you, as you're getting this word out about this product, I mean, how do you feel about cocktails? Like, do you feel that your gin should be treated specially, or are you like, no, put it in there, make it happen. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it works very well in a wide variety of cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
Since we, you know, are with it all the time, we tend to like it straight,
mm-hmm.
or maybe with just a tiny splash of water to open the aromas up a little bit.
Mm.
But you know, lots of different cocktails, you know, it fits very nicely in. And as far as where we are, right now we're distributed only in the district.
Okay.
And at the distillery on Fenwick Street, we sell there, and we're also in probably about a dozen high-end liquor stores.
Well, if you love gin, folks, start asking your restaurateurs and your liquor stores for Green Hat Gin. It's
really delicious.
You know, I'm not big on gin straight. This has a lovely kind of sweetness to it.
I'm not big on anything straight, but this is sippable.
Mm. We've been getting that a lot.
You know, I
don't typically drink just straight, but it's really, really sippable.
Right. It really is.
All right.
Really,
well, John Uselton.
Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Are the artists behind Green Hat Gin.
Yeah,
and speaking of artists, let's switch right over. I guess if anybody can tell us about gin. I don't know if he drinks it personally, but it's Phil Green, who's a founding member of the American Cocktail Museum, but who has written a sterling book that I'm probably halfway through it, called To Have and Have Another. It's a Hemingway cocktail companion. And Phil, let's get into it. Hemingway loved the art of the cocktail. He said that drinking is a release. It's the irresponsibility that comes from the terrible responsibility of writing, which is a great excuse for drinking more. I mean, you obviously love the cocktail, but how'd you fall in love with Hemingway and follow him on this path?
Well, the ironic thing, I read Hemingway for the first time in high school, like most of us did, and it was a short story called Big Two-Hearted River, where I had just been on a backpacking trip, and it took place in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, young man is on a backpacking trip. And I connected with it because of the way he described the campfire and setting up camp and fishing. But he has coffee in that. There are no drinks in that at all. But just throughout reading his prose, and other authors too, like Ian Fleming, I always felt drawn to the ones who were talking about what they were eating and drinking. It sort of filled out the scene a little bit better, put you in the scene.
Well, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back,
We do, okay.
Right? Am I right, Andy? We have to take a quick break. But one of the things I think is really interesting is that I think mixologists in general have this sort of affinity for Hemingway, and there's sort of this...
Oh, it's romantic.
You know, natural love for him.
He was a raconteur.
The first half of the century, he was, with apologies to Dos Equis, he was the world's most interesting man. I mean, he was bullfighting.
No apologies necessary.
Fighting wars.
He was the real thing.
Deep sea fishing and safaris. And he didn't have a publicist. He was doing this all...
Any man that can deep sea fish on a safari is my kind of man. That's what I say.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to hear more about some of the unique stories of Hemingway and his cocktails. We'll be back with Phil Green in just a sec.
This week I've been looking at solar chargers for my iPhone. Last week I was out and about and my iPhone went dead as a doornail. And I thought to myself, you know, there's all this sunlight. Why couldn't I get a solar charger for this? And there are a number of solar chargers out there. Now, the charge time varies anywhere from 6 hours to 12 hours, depending on which one you get. But at least you can get something going.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
It's about smiles. It's about laughter. It's about going out and making a difference in the life of a child. You don't have to get mad. You just have to go mad. GoMad2011.com is a website dedicated to supporting the Make-A-Wish Foundation. At GoMad, our mission is simple, to go out and make a difference. So how can you help? Visit the Wish Wall on GoMad2011.com and make a contribution today. Or find out how you can donate with a simple text message. Do it now so that we can continue to touch the lives of children with life-threatening conditions by granting their wishes.
As winter approaches, relaxing on a patio becomes but a memory. Or does it? Not at Penn Quarter's Postmodern Brasserie. They are transforming their upper courtyard into a cozy, winter-warm outdoor lounge. I'm talking couches, ambient lighting, heat lamps, and cozy warming blankets. You'll enjoy tasty treats, of course, from Chef Dennis Marin. Think sweet hot fondues and warm winter cocktails. Lots of libations to keep you nice and warm throughout the winter. Enjoy the Post Patio Tuesdays through Saturdays this winter from 4 p.m. to close and enjoy the outdoors all winter long.
Diary entry, August 15th. My joints ache. Today I can hardly move. I need some answers.
September 3rd. I'm tired all the time. What's going on?
June 8th. I woke up with a rash on my face. I want to know why.
For answers, ask your doctor the right question. Could I have lupus? For answers, for support, for hope, visit couldihavelupus.gov or call 1-800-994-9662. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health and the Ad Council.
We're back on Foodie and the Beast with David and Nikki Nellis. And before we get back to Phil Green, I just want to thank the folks that make this show possible. And I want to say to Jacques Herringer that if you're not a sponsor of this show, David, you shouldn't feel terrible. You just, you know, you'll think about it. All right. I want to thank Georgetown Bakery, the Neighborhood Restaurant Group, Founding Farmers, including the new Founding Farmers out in Potomac, Farmer Fisher and Baker, Blacks, our friends at Kimpton, the Kimpton Monaco and Post, and, of course, Union Market and the American Land Board, where we had a lot of fun last week. If you guys were you there?
I was there, yes.
Dude.
I was watching your show from afar.
Were you?
Wasn't it fun?
It was a really good time.
Was that field research or was that?
I live near there, and we usually hit the market on Sunday mornings, unless I'm on the radio here. So.
Right,
I thought
exactly.
I saw you. That's why
I
recognize.
Open until 8, so you can always get back
there. I still can, yes.
Let's get back to Phil, because we're talking about Hemingway and cocktails, and you had a really interesting line. You said it's not about how much he drank, but what he drank and how he wrote about it. So, I mean, you know, the impression of him is that he was, you know, at the end he was a mess. He was bipolar and alcoholic and he blew his brains out. But you feel that the liquor was really an expression of... It was not an impediment.
Don't bring
it was
us down,
spur.
Honey.
Well,
lay
I mean,
out.
That's what the guy did. He ended up a mess.
Well, I had to be careful when I wrote the book to not be celebrating excessive drinking or celebrating... You know, self-destructive behavior. He had a
so
very...
like, don't look at this studio right now with the bottles right. everywhere and the empty
it's all
glasses.
Moderation. It's
I mean,
all
really,
moderation.
Right?
No, but he never drank when he wrote. This was something that would help him refill the well overnight of the creative juices. And he was very disciplined about writing in the morning, not mixing drink with his work. And by the end of his life, you know, we now look at NFL football players and taking their own life, concussions. He had 12 or 15 concussions. He was in two plane crashes. A skylight fell on his head. But he had a very painful life emotionally
and physically. What? The skylight fell on his head?
He thought he was pulling the chain on a toilet, mm-hmm. and the skylight fell out of the ceiling in Paris.
If you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball.
But we were talking about gin earlier. He often relied on gin as sort of an anesthetic mm-hmm. or antiseptic. He said, I do not work for the Gordon's gin people, and this is a testimonial which I offer freely and what I hope is my right mind. This beverage is one of the sovereign antiseptics of our time. Gordon's gin is of approved merit and can be counted on to fortify, mollify, and cauterize practically all internal or external injuries.
He probably meant green hat.
Put that coat on your bottle.
And that was the Gordon's before it went to lower proof.
Your book is sort of, it's a biography and a mixography, and you've got his, a bunch of cocktail recipes in here.
And you're planning on making a cocktail right now. What are you making?
I'm going to make the Jack Rose. Most people make the Jack Rose in the very traditional three-part sour formula.
For those who know what a Jack Rose is.
Jack
Can you
Rose
start from
is
scratch?
A classic cocktail with an ounce and a half to 2 ounces of Applejack or Calvados, apple brandy, maybe 3/4 of an ounce of lime juice or lemon juice, and then maybe a half an ounce of grenadine. And it's just a very simple formula. That's the sour. So it's the same thing as a margarita, the same thing as a daiquiri, just with different components.
Okay.
Now, researching the book, I knew that there was a bar that Hemingway frequented called Harry's New York Bar. Mm-hmm. The owner of the bar, Harry McElhone, wrote a cocktail book called Barflies and Cocktails. It came out at the same time as The Sun Also Rises. Now, the Jack Rose was featured in The Sun Also Rises, written at the same time in the same city. So I decided to use or to speculate that this was the drink that Jake Barnes was drinking at the Hotel Crillon, not the simple one that we know of today, but a much more complicated one. And I can make it for you right now.
Okay.
We're going to be using an ounce and a half of Laird's Applejack, 3/4 of an ounce of Plymouth Gin, 3/4 of an ounce of Noilly Pratt dry vermouth, 3/4 of an ounce of Martini sweet vermouth, 3/4 third of an ounce of orange juice, fresh orange juice, 3/4 of an ounce of lime juice.
This doesn't sound complicated at all. Keep going.
It's sort of the Jack Rose meets the Bronx cocktail. It's two classics.
Can you say that backwards?
Right.
All right. Well, while Phil's doing that, let's talk to Chris real quick because we're mixing our drinks here. But you mixed up something here. What do we got?
That's the last one I have for you today. That's our hard cider float. It's on our dessert menu at Trademark and kind of gets to where my expertise falls in, working closely with Matthew. While you find a lot of bartenders these days are mixologists, they want to go sweet or sour. I'm trying to get more into the savory side, food. Mm-hmm. And we got a great cocktail coming up for the Thanksgiving holiday, calling it the in-law cure-all.
Oh, is that what you went with? That's a great name.
Yes.
I had the cocktail. We were trying to name
night.
It.
Exactly.
Right.
So we're using some gin.
I'll
beam
take
with
two.
That. You'll need it. It's good.
I don't even have in-laws, but if I...
Your in-laws are all dead.
I know.
You lucky dog.
I know.
So it's a bourbon-based cocktail. I did a butternut squash soda, so it's real savory. Then topped it with a little bit of a cranberry port reduction. So in the butternut squash soda, you got a little bit of cinnamon, some allspice, some sage. But I'm really trying to find those savory notes that maybe people haven't experienced yet. So it's kind of what we're doing new over down at Trademark. Mm-hmm. Matthew and I are working close together to...
Say Matthew, that's the chef.
Right. Matthew is our chef at Trademark, fantastic guy. We're working together, trying to bring it to one of the new cocktail food places in Old Town.
All right, Great. We're close to wrapping up. Why don't you give the street address of Trademark?
400 Courthouse Square. We're located right in Carlisle inside the Westin Hotel.
Okay, right. Well, Phil, let's go back to you. So now that you've made this, tell us what kind of research you had to do. Considering your participation with the Museum of the American Cocktail, did you know a lot of this stuff already? How much research did you have to do for the book?
I had a good foundation, but what I tried to do was rely on the, the you know,